The following is intended for bizarre audiences only. Welcome to the Midnight Library.
Madam, the guest occupying the Red Room hasn't been seen for days. Should we be concerned about them?
I believe that particular guest requested solitude and solace for the length of their stay, darling. And there's been no screaming heard.
I've not heard any thumps, but I'll just check if they've been frightened enough to hurl themselves from the room's balcony.
Mr. Darling, I always think of you as a fang-dripping monster, and I forget how gentle and caring you can be.
Yes. You see if he's jumped. I don't have to chase him. It's like having a meal delivered for free.
Glorious. Good evening, everyone. Please gather in. How wonderful to see those of you who made it here alive. There we are. Just as you make your way to a comfy spot, you'll notice there's complimentary punch on the hospitality tray this evening. It's just a little something our Natasha has whipped up in preparation for a special guest we're expecting. What's in it? Just lots of good and wholesome things and not blood. Nope. Punchy type ingredients like you find in punch, you know. And there's a bit of delectable crab meat and several different kinds of normal cheeses on the tray as well. And we insist that you sample all of it as much as you like. Go on. You'll be fine. Welcome to the Midnight Library, everyone. I am your hospitable host, Miranda Merrick. I'm willing to venture forth a confident bet that many of you here are voracious readers. I feel secure in my statement because I see the lustful, longing looks in your soulful eyes as you file past our alluring, beautiful, locked bookcases. I see you desperately peering through the exquisitely etched glass, squinting and straining to try to get near enough to read some of the charming inlaid gilded runes on their rich and supple leather spines, even placing your nose near the windowed doors, trying to breathe in their heady perfume of musty vanilla, dreaming of the delicate warmth of their finely milled ivory pages, gently rasping against your hungry fingertips. I need to stop talking like this. Anyway, I would also be willing to bet that some of you are writers, too. And that is a horse of a different flavor altogether. The thing about writing is, if you're being made to do it for some reason, and you have no interest in it or no flair for it, being made to write can be a kind of torture, and not the fun kind. I'm sure if you think back to your days at school, depending on the subject you were required to learn, or the accompanying activity you were obligated to take part in, this directed whether you were happy or utterly miserable. As humans, you've no doubt noticed that it is nearly impossible to find any care or enjoyment in something with which you have personally no resonance. You can't paint a picture if you don't want to. You can't hex someone if your heart's not in it. I mean, you can't play a sport that you couldn't care less about. You can't assign fascinating words to paper if you have no interest in doing so. You simply cannot. It goes against your nature. I believe this is your soul whispering a message to you from a time before you even existed. We all have things that we know deep down are meant for us. Now, are serial killers from a young age ultimately meant to be serial killers? If they're good at it, yes. I mean, I don't know. But what I do know is that when you're young and you find yourself drawn to nearly any given interest in the world, especially if it's a positive thing like art, science, math, reading, music, the occult, or writing, and sports, I suppose, and you are allowed to, or even encouraged, to pursue your innate desire for these chosen interests, well, this has supplied the world with some of the most valued gifts and advancements across hundreds or even thousands of given fields in human existence. Hopefully, someone around you encouraged you to take part in the things you felt a gravitational pull of early on. Can you imagine if someone had said to Da Vinci, "Lenny, stop scribbling and playing in the mud. You're going to be a hunter like your Uncle Jeff." Oh, I'd just like to say, I'm so thankful no one ever discouraged Bram Stoker. Tonight, I'm going to do something a little differently here in the reading room. Not that, whatever you were thinking. I'm going to tell you the enticing tale of how Mr. Stoker became the famed writer that he was, and how he developed the iconic character of his masterpiece, Dracula. And then I'm going to invite you back next time and hope that you make it here safely to hear its partner piece on vampires and blood-drinking cults. I figure once we're in, we may as well go all in. And who among us doesn't love a bloodbath? Seriously, if you don't, this may not be the place for you. The rest of you are right where you belong, and we couldn't be more pleased that you're here. This fine evening, I want to share with you what a gift the supremely terrifying character of Dracula, summoned up and made real to the world by Abraham Bram Stoker, is. And what a painstaking and dedicated process brought him to us. The novel and the legendary character took more than a dozen years to materialize. Little by little, all of the disturbing elements that encompass the persona of Dracula were collected and decreed by Stoker. You'll hear how he had just the right childhood, visited just the right places, met just the right people, and even had just the right nightmare in order to bring into reality the literary gift that is Dracula. Let me tell you, dear guests, there's a reason why the beloved novel, since published over 120 years ago, has never been out of print. Now, like many a talented writer, Stoker was from Ireland. Born in 1847 in Dublin, it is known that he had a rather peculiar start in life, as he was quite a sickly child. This ailment, whatever its nature, was either never actually diagnosed or has never been disclosed in any writing discovered about him. What is known is that from his infancy to about the age of 7, he was poorly and spent much of his time in bed, and that his dear mother, Charlotte, caringly read him gruesome stories that she was fond of to while away his listless days in repose. She had lived through the horrific cholera epidemic of 1832, and apparently had a kind of looming darkness about her, thankfully. There's even a theory that little Brahm may have picked up his compulsive fascination with blood at this time, because he may have been subjected to the ghoulish practice of bloodletting, which was still in use at this time, as treatment for many ailments, a treatment even for children, who were said to be sickly. As a young man, Bram Stoker was said to be a bright student. Later in 1864, he attended Dublin's Trinity College, where, interestingly, he studied mathematics, but always had an interest in writing. Being the industrious type, he managed to work as a civil servant while attending university. Round about the same time, he began to take an interest in journalism, and even wrote as employment by becoming a part-time drama critic, thus beginning his involvement in the theater. So here, we see him as a young man, and we can already detect the slight colors of his own character that would become so vivid to us through his writing later on. You may also like to know that he wrote for personal companionship as well, and like many of us, he had pen pals. Only his letter-writing correspondents were none other than Oscar Wilde and Walt Whitman, and not other strange women holed up in ancient libraries with a cast of otherworldly characters, all in league with hellish dark forces. One might guess. Stoker was an early fan of a writing genre at the time known by the charming title of dark romanticism. This manner of writing took the good nature of romanticism and added the more interesting angle of letting its characters gravitate toward or to even embrace their dark sides, their foibles, or downright evil natures. A few authors you may recognize who wrote in the sinister style, in many but perhaps not all of their works, were Emily Dickinson, Herman Melville, and of course, our sainted Edgar Allan Poe. Stoker's first essays that became his published works sometimes embraced the famously brooding and willful dreariness of dark romanticism, but the elements he pulled together for his future book were far darker, more like gothic horror. If you're looking for a little real-life dark romance, tonight's reading is brought to you by the Broom and Fang Pub. So it's another solo late night, and you're feeling a lonely pang. We invite you along to date night on down at the Broom and Fang. Ride with us or arrive on your own, grab a drink and a seat at the bar. There's no need to be all alone if you're willing to meet the bizarre. Sip some wine with a girl with a tail. Dance with a strange man in a cloak. Meet a spirit who is beyond the pale. Meet a demon made entirely of smoke. Have a bite with darling's brother in a booth in our secret saloon. If you find you're not into each other, you can trade him in for a goon. We'll never tell who you're alone with in the creepiest Lonely Hearts Club. We just want to see who you go home with on date night at the Broom and Fang Pub. Date night at the Broom and Fang Pub will feature actual Bloody Marys, goblin snot shots, and witch's milk wine. If you become tipsy, Mr. Darling will drive you home safely in his classic hearse, the Studebaker Undertaker. We'll see you down at the Broom and Fang Pub. Bram Stoker's love for the theater granted him the good fortune to meet a man that would help him along in several ways with his dark literary pursuits. In 1877, he met and became friends with the famed actor Henry Irving. As luck would have it, Stoker attended a performance by Irving in a play in Dublin. Once Irving read Stoker's sophisticated and prudent review of his acting abilities, he invited him to a dinner party, during which Stoker later wrote that he witnessed Irving's recitation of a dramatic poem, a performance he found to be so passionate and riveting. Stoker declared that Irving had made an indelible impression upon him then and there. And what does this happening have to do with anything, I hear you thinking? Why would the actor Irving's dinner theatrics be of any significance? Well, many believe it was this performance by Irving that ignited the fire of an idea in Stoker's mind. The idea of a forceful, commanding character that could hold his audience spellbound with the power of his presence. In fact, Irving had made such an impression upon Stoker, and in turn Stoker upon Irving, that not long after their friendship was established, when Irving offered Stoker the position of manager and personal advisor, Stoker uprooted himself from Dublin and moved to London to accept the hired position, a job he would make into a career of 28 years. The two men then worked together amicably and reliably the entire time. In 1890, when Stoker began writing Dracula, his masterpiece, he designed his lead beast and described his horrid fiend thusly.
His face was a very strong aquiline, with a high bridge of the thin nose and peculiarly arched nostrils, with lofty domed forehead and hair growing scantily around the temples but profusely elsewhere. His eyebrows were very massive, almost meeting over the nose, and with bushy hair that seemed to curl in its own profusion.
Now, what is so striking about this exactingly detailed description is that if you look at images of Henry Irving, you will see it matches him to a terrifying T. So Irving, willing or not, aware or not, served as the visual model for Dracula's creature-like features. But what about that compelling name, Count Dracula? It rings so perfectly within the ear. No other name could have ever served its audience so well, and with such impact. Let's try a little experiment to reiterate the obvious, shall we? I'll pronounce for you a few alternative names. Count Durwood. No. Count Dillman. No. Perhaps with three syllables. Count Dibbleyburg. No. It has to be Dracula, and only Count Dracula. The choosing of the name Dracula, and the divinely spooky settings too, turn out to be the result of a fortuitous turn of events. Bram Stoker was given to visiting the town of Whitby, frequently taking holiday breaks there. He even became a member of the Whitby Library. And why is this so interesting? Because amongst the historic, lovely old books that are still there in the library, researchers and historians have been able to tell which books Stoker checked out when he visited to do his own research. Following the trail of his detailed notes, it is believed that he read widely about strange old legends and folklore beliefs, such as vampires, which had been part of folklore for centuries. Two key books that he definitely plucked from the library shelves. First, a gruesome little book dynamically entitled The Book of Werewolves, written in 1865 by Sabine Baron Gold, is thought to have inspired Stoker to endow Dracula with his unholy alliance with wolves. And by the reading of a little-known mysterious old book, a treatise on the principalities of Wallachia and Moldova from the year 1820, Stoker discovers the name that would forever embed itself in the hearts and minds of millions of bloodthirsty fans the world over. Dracula. The page bearing the name in the 200-year-old book even has its top corner dog-eared, perhaps by Stoker's own decisive fingers. There's even a real chance that Stoker, whilst on one of his many visits to the town of Whitby, may have had the, shall we say, good fortune to witness the terrible wreck of the Russian schooner, the Dmitri. The goods-laden ship was tossed ashore in a raging storm in October of 1885. Landing broken upon the sands of Collier's Hope in Whitby. And if you recall, Dracula finds his way to shore in the exact same fashion. A shipwreck, except the ship that bore him, Stoker christened the Demeter. Tonight's reading at the Midnight Library is brought to you by the first run, first edition of Dracula, both written and signed by Bram Stoker. The eerie yellow cloth-bound book with deep red Gothic lettering would like you to know just how far it is out of your league. Impossibly high and far away, upon a gleaming shelf, resting on a gilded tray in a casket by itself, Dracula, the Master's Book, holds the writer's fearsome spirit. Your eyes will never get a look. You've no hope of getting near it. The book, you see, was willed to us by none other than Mr. Stoker. His spirit is quietly thrilled with us to be its eternal broker. Bram and his book are aware that you're here, but never intend to meet you. They only care to watch and sneer, while some other monster eats you. You may love to hate many a book, dear guests, but only the original Dracula by Bram Stoker hates you first. We just thought you'd like to know. This next fact I'm going to share with you, my dear guests, is one that I admit I've been saving, but that I'm positively bursting to tell you. It is so deliciously macabre and delightfully grim. And because you know me well enough by now to know how much I love, believe in, and rely upon the value of dreams, I am thrilled to tell you that Bram Stoker himself reported that he believed his hellish inspiration came to him after partaking of a rich meal of dressed crab and falling into a deep sleep, during which he suffered a ghastly nightmare. He found himself locked in a petrifying vision, featuring three ghoulish vampire brides descending upon a single male victim. hungrily about to sink their fangs into him and drain him of his life-giving blood. In the tormenting dream, Stoker saw Dracula appear, commanding the weird women to stand down, speaking aloud the book's famous line,
"This man belongs to me."
This means that one of the world's most obsessively treasured pieces of Gothic literature and most feared and idolized characters, Dracula, was likely brought into reality by materializing first in a fevered night terror, presumably induced by the consummation of crab meat topped with cheese. Oops. Good night, my dear guests. Please stay within the cordoned off areas of the library as Mr. Darling sees you safely to the door. Let me wish you, modestly, safe travels home or to the Broom and Fang pub, and let me encourage you to begin keeping your own dream journal, just in case you happen to be the next Bram Stoker. Sweet dreams, my dear guest. Good night.
Bram Stoker! What a tale, madam! I am rather disappointed that our guest in the Red Room rudely failed to attend your fine reading.
I'm only concerned that he vacates the Red Room now, as we're expecting to let the room to the Count himself tonight, and the maids need to prepare it.
Madam, who is the guest currently occupying the Red Room?
It's Father Philbrook, and if he doesn't appear downstairs in the next 4 minutes, you may drag him.
4 minutes? 4 minutes! Fingers crossed. Oh, please let it happen. Please let it happen.
Oh, how about I move the clock up?
Yippee!
The Midnight Library is proudly brought to you by me, Miranda Merrick, and Astonishing Legends. The excellent sound design is by Chris at Sounds Like an Earful. We are kindly sponsored by our spooky, lovely patrons. If you would like to do as they've done and step beyond the cordoned off areas, visit patreon.com/midnightlibrary. Join our Patreon and you'll hear directly from me. Just make sure your notifications are on. Find us in your local cemetery and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our bizarre merch can be found at redbubble.com/people/midnightlibrary.